Yes, indeedly dee.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the Hour of the Con, and I'm Michelle. I will be your host for this program and for as many subsequent programs as it takes to complete the coverage of the material I'm going to begin with you tonight. Over the past few years, I've had the great opportunity to meet many of you on the field, to talk to you on the phone, to get to know you a little better. And without question, the most often requested information that has been presented to me is the request for training about the underground resistance movement and what we on the field can do and should be thinking about with regard to preserving our family life, protecting our liberties. And so we're going to be looking tonight at the basic training handbook of the American Underground. You will probably want to have pencil and paper handy, or if possible, roll audio cassette tape on these programs, because the information will be very valuable to you. I would preface this presentation with the remark that you do not approach material like this from the perspective of looking for specific strategies or tactics. Rather, you look for broad principles that can be applied or modified to suit a variety of circumstances and conditions. There is no way that you can predict accurately ever exactly what your condition or circumstance may be, and this is the benefit that we have from studying history or studying strategy or studying tactics, is to find the broad applicable principles. The material I will be reviewing with you this evening is somewhat dated, and of course we approach material like this with the understanding that we are not anti-government. Our government is the Constitution for the United States of America, and this we support to our last breath. How that government is being manipulated or distorted or twisted or destroyed is another story entirely. But we are not anti-government. You may find some of the language in this handbook that we were reviewing perhaps a little inflammatory, but again, I request that you look at this from the perspective of principle, realize the material is somewhat dated, and look for what you can use and apply. So we'll take a little break here, and we will jump into the material and be ready with pencil and paper.
Gentlemen, tonight's broadcast is brought to you by the Intelligence Service of the Second Continental Army of the Republic, Militia.
Thank you.
The Basic Training Handbook of the American Immigrant. American Immigrant. Is this the name of a new organization? Is it politically to the right or left? How can the term be applied to any activities presently within the United States? Underground is generally defined by most dictionaries as a secret organization fighting established government or occupation forces. 200 years ago, many underground groups were in existence to fight for the cause of freedom. Members of one well-known fraternal organization met, conspired, and perpetrated the act of dumping tea into the Boston Harbor. This is but one example of many underground activities of that time in history. Since that time, and particularly within the last few decades, various groups and organizations have come and gone. Usually served by a biased news media, these groups came into existence as a vehicle to fight what their leaders and membership consider to be paramount for the social ills at hand. Although having their own identities as to enemies to fight, they usually centered around governmental activities that have resulted in unbelievable taxation and encroachment of personal liberty. These underground groups have existed largely as small, autonomous organizations with their leadership confined to their local area. Trials at national leadership have been made with varying degrees of success. No one leader has yet reached the level of opposition. Perhaps this is largely due to the quality of the general membership. Proponents of individual freedom seem to be the last to be motivated by herd instinct. The more professional underground groups have had membership training programs of varying degrees. The training lessons reproduced in this manual have been in existence for many years and have been modified and used by several groups. An original authorship remains unknown. Capabilities of underground warfare. The capabilities of underground warfare depend on many different factors, such as the size of the area involved, type of terrain, density of population, anti-guerrilla activities, and many other factors. Most important of all is the degree of freedom afforded the civilian population. Cuba serves as an example. When Castro was in the mountains fighting Batista, his band was in constant contact with the civilian population. From them, he received information, warning of approaching troops, food, and supplies. The fact that civilians were allowed to travel at will in the foothills made it possible for Castro agents and Joanna Cope to move in disguise to and from his mountain retreat. After Castro came to power and anti-Castro guerrillas were in the mountains, the situation was much different. Castro cleared the no-man's land. Thus isolated, the anti-Castro forces could not smuggle in supplies and new recruits. They were deprived of the guerrillas' first means of obtaining information and advance warning of enemy attacks. Another comparison can be made between the Nazi conquest of France and the Chinese communists in Tibet. Although the Germans were often brutal, they did at times display an unexpected degree of chivalry and a sense of fair play. One of the three principal leaders of the French underground was arrested, but he was not executed. Later, he escaped and made his way to England. After being re-equipped, he parachuted back into France and directed guerrilla forces for 2 more years, which resulted in widespread sabotage and untold damage to the German war effort. During all of this time, the guerrilla leader's family lived in France in comparative comfort and safety. The Germans knew who this man was. They knew where his wife and 7 children lived. They could have had his family as hostages and threatened to torture them unless he surrendered, but they did not. Compare this with the communist treatment of civilians in Tibet, Africa, and Southeast Asia. After the communist conquest of Tibet, families were systematically broken up and separated. Adults over 50 were killed or turned out to starve. Children under 15 were shipped to China for communist indoctrination. Married couples were separated. Most men were castrated to make them docile and then sent to slave labor camps. Women were systematically impregnated to start raising a new generation of half-Chinese, half-Tibetan communists. Under conditions such as we have described in France, underground warfare is not only possible, but almost certain. Under conditions as they now exist in Tibet, guerrilla warfare is almost impossible. If the United States ever falls victim to communism, either from within or from without, we must expect treatment as befits our role as the major deterrent to the communist goal of world conquest. Whether such conditions are imposed on our people quickly or slowly probably depends on whether we fight it out or surrender meekly. Sooner or later, the results will be the same. This does not mean that guerrilla warfare against the communist regime in the United States is impossible. It simply means that we must start making our plans and preparations without delay. It means also that we must fight to the death, if necessary, to prevent communist conquest. We must not wait until all hope of victory is gone before we start to fight back. We are facing a determined and crafty enemy. He has thrown away the rules of decency and fair play. He has written an entirely new book of rules. He has written into it every dirty trick and below-the-belt blow that he can think of. If we fail to adopt his set of rules, then we are beaten before we start. In our present situation, we have no other choice but to use every one of the enemy's tricks, just a few new ones of our own. Given reasonable conditions of environment and sufficient advance preparation, guerrillas can inflict extreme damage on an enemy and can ultimately lead to the defeat of forces far more numerous and better equipped than themselves. The examples are numerous. Lawrence of Arabia brought about the eventual defeat of Turkey with bands that never totaled over 1,000. For 2 years during the Boer War, a small band of Boer guerrillas held down 250,000 British troops. In Palestine, a handful of fanatics were able to duplicate the strength of an army corps. During World War II, Germany lost as much or more material to guerrilla and underground forces as it did to conventional armies. In one period of just 7 hours, the Russian guerrillas made over 1,000 separate raids against German forces and installations. Just imagine the number of troops that would be required to guard against such widespread guerrilla warfare. The French armies in Vietnam were more numerous, better equipped, and more skillful at conventional warfare. Yet they were ultimately defeated by ragged and illiterate natives that drifted around their outposts and between their lines like smoke through screen wire. The total cost of equipment and supplies by enemy forces in Laos would probably not exceed $500,000. The U.S. has spent over 1,000 times that amount on economic and military assistance that is still really essential to communism. Castro guerrillas still outnumbered 1,000 to 1 by the regular army from the time that Batista fled Cuba. The communists think they have a monopoly on guerrilla warfare. We can show them differently. Ever hear of the camera? In no other country is the practical joke so widely appreciated or so ingeniously applied as it is in the United States. Sabotage is a practical joke carried to its ultimate extreme. We doubt that the communists can even imagine what they would be up against with the occupation army in North America. During World War II, the German occupation army in Norway numbered one German for every 18 Norwegians. Yet the German troops hardly dared walk the streets at night. German forces occupied Denmark with an average of 6 Germans per square mile. And even though the civilians of that country had few arms of their own, Germans never completely stamped out the underground activity. And occupy a land mass of over 8 million square miles. It is estimated that the total population of the United States alone had in its possession over 60 million workers, black and people. An exaggeration, let's consider that Winchester Arms Company was 3.5 million rifles of one single model. Billion rounds of ammunition. Americans to arm ourselves through restricted anti-gun laws. In the present circumstances, the occupants were 10 times greater than the total standing army of Russia and China combined. Of course, they might raise an army sufficiently large, but if they sent their armies over there, they would keep control over their own. They're sure to come up with a young American. It is the American people who fail to control their own control. The time they come up with a from getting a law passed, which would require civilians to register or turn in their homes. The second time comes, there will still be enough of us left to go. Perhaps the greatest guerrilla fighters of all time were the American Indians. They lost their battle against the white men not because of poorer weapons or lesser numbers, but rather because they did not realize their danger soon enough and take action while victory was still possible. They also spent considerable time fighting among themselves. If we lose our battle against communism, it will likely be for the same reason. Strategy of guerrilla warfare. In its strategy, technique, and operation, guerrilla warfare is almost the exact opposite of conventional warfare. Conventional warfare is designed to bring the greatest possible concentrations of power to focus at the proper time and place by which the enemy forces can be overwhelmed and sufficiently captured. Guerrilla warfare must be conducted as to concentrate. If they can be so called, have a totally different character. There is no battlefield in the proper sense of the word, and not one large blow, but a number of smaller ones are struck ceaselessly in all directions and at all times. One might expect that guerrilla warfare would become less effective as the scientific and technical weapons of war become increasingly more powerful and more complicated. Exactly the opposite is true. Modern armies, like modern governments, have become so bureaucratic that their general commands are usually unable to make or change plans quickly and decisively. Straitjacketed as they are by rigid discipline, junior officers, smaller units, and even the individual soldiers are almost incapable of effective independent action. The guerrilla band, moving faster than the reaction time of conventional forces, may be compared to the small but agile matador that toys with an enraged bull. With every rush, the bull receives another painful jab. charging wildly here and there, the bull soon dissipates its strength and is at last exhausted and beaten, just waiting for the coup de grace. Next continues, without underestimating in any way the importance of large-scale employment of modern weapons, man remains the being whose soul brings life to the machine. Thanks to individual combatants, completely disregarding all instinct of self-preservation, can easily succeed in destroying the most deadly and complicated engines of war. The history of the last conflict proves this cause. Not only has guerrilla warfare survived into the era of airplanes, tanks, and mass armies, but in that era, it has reached its highest development. Guerrilla strategy strives to overcome material superiority, not by the acquirement of more perfect material or by greater numbers, but rather by the use of superior intelligence, greater mobility, and the ultimate degree of courage. Whereas conventional forces try to maintain contact with the enemy, guerrilla forces strive to avoid contact. The essential strategy of guerrilla warfare is said to be the art of constantly escaping from the enemy. Guerrilla bands never seek to hold or occupy territory, not even their own hideout if it can be discovered. Their very existence, even without contact, causes the enemy to expend his energies to guard against them and thus constantly drain the enemy forces of their strength. Instead of driving enemy columns around, the guerrillas strive to constantly lure them farther and farther from their source of supply. Instead of cutting off the enemy outpost supplies entirely, thus forcing them to retreat, the guerrillas allow short rations to reach such outposts so as to keep them there. The longer they stay, the weaker and more depressed they become. A regular soldier can occupy only the territory within range of his gun. Without a definite target, he is helpless. Thus, a cardinal part of guerrilla strategy is to deny the enemy definite targets. This is not to imply that guerrilla warfare is easy. Just the contrary, it requires an ultimate in skill, cunning, and physical endurance. The matador need make only one mistake, and he ends up in the bull's horns. There are five conditions essential to successful guerrilla warfare. 1. The guerrillas must be intimately acquainted with the area in which they are fighting. 2. They must have plenty of space in which to maneuver. 3. The tenacity, patriotism, and courage of the people must be such as to enable them to fight this type of war. 4. The war must last long enough to allow the underground movement to develop. And 5. The guerrilla forces must receive support from their regular army, from a foreign power, or from a wide cross-section of the general population. Thank you. I played the rubber song from Notre Dame, specifically for you. Because I want you to take a moment and think about the men in your life, whether they're your husband, your fathers, your sons, the men in your life with whom you've made an emotional investment. Consider for a moment the very real possibility that at some time in the future, you may be separated from these wonderful men. They may be called out onto the field to do a job to fight for our liberty. Some of them may not ever come back. We must also consider the possibility that at some point in the future, we might need to buy back their life or to buy the information of their whereabouts. When you're living in a country that is occupied by the enemy or in a cashless society, you will be reduced to trading on the black market, dealing with the enemy, or working strictly with the underground, and you must have precious metals to do this. There are very few marketable skills or service skills that we women have that are tradable in value to the equivalent of a human life. So think about the necessity of having precious metals on hand as a life preserver. If you have not personally called Swiss Method Trading to talk to them about precious metals, I encourage you to do that. My phone number is 1-
Ladies and gentlemen, disregard all commercials, telephone numbers, special offers, addresses, all of that kind of stuff. What Michelle has just told you is absolutely 100% true. You must consider what she told you. Where you obtain your precious metals, however, is up to you. It's up to you. Swiss Method Trading was a sponsor of this broadcast in the past. If you wish to deal with it, please do so. If you wish to deal with some of your precious metals, please do that also. But make sure that you have the means to protect yourselves, your lives, and your family.
So don't postpone that phone call any longer. Have Swiss Method Trading. Talk to them. You don't have to have a lot of money to invest. They can arrange a program for you, a single purchase, or whatever amount of money you have to invest. And you will have made a step in the right direction towards preserving your income, your assets, and possibly preserving the life of your loved ones. So call Swiss America Trading, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646.
I'm going to say that. Hold it, Papa Sean.
High on a barrel of land, the full red light, the thunder and the thunder, and the same shot, the right shot, the cross and bayonet, the thing through. Tell me, Sean, what the gun was the one in the game, that's the right, oh, yeah. Yeah. Like your soldier and son, they're sending you home, so you want money, what the time comes through. They carried him home and they cut him down with a military pension and a medal from the crown. You haven't to know, you haven't to know that the enemy nearly flew. Now you have to go out on the street to pray. So poor Johnny, what the fate do?
The difference between the mercenary foreign invading soldier and the operatives of the underground is the courage of conviction and the moral high ground. These two factors are far greater motivators and will result in victory. Underground movements engage in five separate but overlapping activities. One, intelligence, which involves gathering information about the enemy, passing such information on to friendly military forces, use of such information in planning the most effective means of sabotage and guerrilla activities, and misdirecting and confusing enemy forces by planting false or misleading information. Two, security. This involves protecting the identity of underground personnel and their families, keeping secret the location, movements, and plans of guerrilla bands, keeping secret the location of guerrilla headquarters, alternate hideouts, and supply depots, protecting the identity of civilians or individual members of the enemy population that are friendly to underground forces, protecting the location of friendly military forces that the underground members may have knowledge of, and maintaining secrecy of communications. Three, propaganda. This is used to convince underground forces themselves of the value of their efforts, the rightness of their cause, and the certainty of ultimate victory. To convince the civilian population that the underground members are true patriots, not bandits, as the enemy will claim, and that it is the duty of the civilian population to render the guerrilla bands every possible assistance, even at certain risk to themselves. To convince enemy forces that they cannot run, to make them doubt the rightness of their own cause, to lower their morale, to confuse their thinking and misdirect their efforts. Propaganda is designed especially to counteract the enemy propaganda. In propaganda, directed to neutral forces and foreign civilians, urges them to join the fight in support of guerrilla forces. Four, sabotage. This involves active sabotage, designed to destroy enemy resources, supplies, communications, and personnel, or passive sabotage, designed to slow production, misdirect shipments, lose critical machine parts, allow perishable merchandise to spoil, and so forth. Number five, guerrilla warfare is involved. Delay enemy troop movement. Scout his forces for information. Destroy enemy scouts and patrols. Ambush enemy columns. Mine roads or buildings apt to be used by the enemy. Trap and misdirect armored spearheads. Road enemy troops or installations. Harass enemy flanks and support forces. Cut supply lines. Systematically snipe at the enemy officers and troops. Deny the enemy use of certain roads, thus concentrating his forces for attack by friendly aircraft. Ambush paratroop or amphibious landings of small parties. Make the enemy chase you, thereby wearing his troops out and spreading them thin. Give the enemy no peace, day or night, good weather or bad. Kidnap high-ranking officers and hold them as protection against a reprisal from friendly civilians. Poison enemy water and food supply. Remove or destroy valuable equipment before it falls into enemy hands. Dominate the open country and keep the enemy confined to his own well-guarded barracks. Maintain continuous psychological pressure on enemy troops. Keep them afraid, lonely, and uncertain. Kill the enemy in every possible way, at every possible opportunity. Recruit new band members and transport them to the band. Maintain systems of supply and distribution, primarily by theft from the enemy or raids upon his supply depot, secondarily from friendly armed forces or by a fair and equitable tax on the civilian population. Supply individual members with forged identity cards, travel permits, etc. At times, skilled guerrilla forces may even counterfeit money or manufacture their own weapons and explosives. Assist in the escape of friendly prisoners held by the enemy. And cooperate to the fullest extent with any friendly military forces. Guerrilla warfare in North America. Should guerrilla warfare occur on the continent, we would certainly expect it to assume a different character than the even if the warfare of Europe. The rebellion almost certain under any form of tyranny. Even among the free nations of Europe, the claim of identity papers has long been accepted as a benefit. There are very few places in the world outside of the United States in which a person can travel for thousands of miles without substituting a tax. Things like travel packets and identity cards would be the very minimum action our totalitarian government will insist on to help them control the population. Yet even this would be dramatic proof to the American people. In other parts of the world, it has generally been found that 90% of the population will submit to occupation by enemy troops without fearing death until their own homes and families are actually attacked. It is believed that a much greater percentage of the American population would be ready to take up arms against a foreign invader or a communist-imposed government. We have already mentioned the large population and immense land mass that would be involved. Land for labor, as we have seen, is one of the necessities of successful guerrilla warfare. Throughout the United States, Canada, and Mexico, a wide variety of terrain and population density would lend itself naturally to implementing sabotage and guerrilla activities. The evacuation of supplies and the support of underground warfare. Even after an atomic holocaust, it is hard to imagine a complete absence of surplus food, including both domestic and wild-growing crops, which the guerrilla band could draw on for sustenance. In the United States proper, the transportation, highway, and road systems are in a completely different class from other areas which have experienced guerrilla warfare. Even in that part of Russia which was occupied by the Germans, the road system was comparatively primitive. Horse-drawn vehicles were common, and the large bulk of the people moved on foot. guerrilla bands in other parts of the world have successfully moved themselves and materials by foot over jungle trails and through mountainous ravines. The distances involved, however, were comparatively small. Through the United States alone, there are literally millions of miles of roads, paved highways, blacktops, gravel roads, and dirt. How is an enemy to keep watch on all of this seemingly endless labyrinth of roads? To the average communist soldier, they would be as confusing as wilderness trails. In view of these differences, it may well be that guerrilla bands operating in the United States could use motor transportation and mechanized weapons to an extent which has not previously been possible in guerrilla warfare. Naturally, we cannot really know whether such fighting will ever be required of us. Neither can we know what kind of enemy we may have to fight or under what conditions. It may be that the guerrilla fighter of the North American continent will be best equipped with a camouflage suit, pack of survival rations, and an automatic rifle. On the other hand, it might well occur that the North American guerrilla will be best camouflaged while wearing a business suit and carrying a briefcase with a silencer-equipped pistol. These are things to consider. Think over now and prepare for the future. Underground training program. It would be a mistake to think that our enemies have one set plan for world conquest. They are maintaining nearly continuous attacks on many fronts at the same time. Military, political, and psychological, both internal and external. They are continuously probing for weak spots in the defenses of the free world. During the past 30 years, so many openings have been left to them by the stupidity and collusion of Western leaders that they have been able to advance almost at will. There is little we can do to change this situation at this time. Rather than deplete our limited resources on futile attempts to do so, we must concentrate on building a workable anti-communist underground army based on realities rather than wishful thinking, and organize on the tried and proven principles of underground warfare. The communists have many, many years of experience in suppressing anti-communist guerrilla activity. If we are to fight them successfully, if we are to hold out until the final victory of freedom over tyranny, and our underground army is going to have to be the most skillful and the most dedicated that the world has ever known. There is only one kind of member that can qualify for such an army, the very best. This will require intensive training and practice. There is no shortcut to perfection. By drawing on the parents of several of our more experienced members, we think we may have a training program that can develop that kind of an underground army. In this program, four different types of training will be involved. Printed materials, tape recordings, pictures, slides, charts, and so forth, sold or loaned to bands or individuals. Actual experience, on-the-job training by doing assignments, and training maneuvers. Due to the difficulty of keeping large training meetings secret, such sessions should be held only for small, select groups that have already completed sufficient preliminary training by other means. Phase 1, Intelligence, Security, and Propaganda. Phase 1 of this training program is designed to give our members basic knowledge and practice in intelligence, security, and propaganda. This first phase is basic preparation for advanced training in these three important activities, which will be dealt with in greater detail further on in the training program. Intelligence. Guerrilla warfare, as we customarily think of it, cannot succeed unless it is supported by a well-developed underground, comprising all the essential functions of intelligence, security, propaganda, communication, supply, medical services, and so forth. Of all of these, intelligence is the most important. Let's consider one example. Suppose you picked up a telephone book, open it up to any page at random, close your eyes, and put your finger to one name. And suppose you read that name for the first time and said to yourself, sometime in the next 30 days, I'm going to kill this man. Consider the situation. One man, picked at random, was marked for death. He might be the most powerful, the wealthiest, the most influential man in the city. But none of these things would help him in the least. He would be defenseless. Why? Because you would have one thing that he did not have. Intelligence. You would know his identity and he would not know yours. So long as that condition continued, there would be no possible way in which you could arrange an adequate defense against you. Exactly the same situation exists between ourselves and our communist socialist enemies. Our success will be directly proportional to our knowledge of them and inversely proportional to their knowledge of us. Whatever a member's principal job may be in the underground army, he must have a basic knowledge of intelligence techniques. This subject is therefore the first to be considered in our training program. And we will continue this in another episode of the Hour of the Time. I thank you for your attention and ask that you weigh these matters very carefully and think about them prayerfully. And until we meet again, may God bless you and God save the Republic.
listening to a special presentation of the Hour of the Time, presented by the Intelligence Service of the 2nd Continental Army of the Republic, Russia. To WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA, 7.415 megahertz, worldwide, shortwave radio.
This is part two of our review of the basic training handbook of the American Underground. We will continue now with our discussion of intelligence. The word intelligence, when used in a military sense, refers to both methods that can be used to gain useful information. We usually think of this as knowledge of the enemy, but it also includes information about the terrain, general population, available supplies, and all other facts that will help in planning future activities. Intelligence is roughly divided into three parts. A, observation. During a hot war, this includes scouting and patrolling, observation of enemy troop movements, etc. On the Cold War front, this includes shadowing of enemy personnel, surveillance of enemy offices, tapping of telephones, interception of messages, and so forth. B. Research and analysis. Collecting and cataloging all possible useful information from general sources. Newspapers, radio, trade magazines, etc., then matching up isolated scraps of information until an accurate picture is obtained of some situation that would not otherwise be known. C. Espionage. This includes the placing or recruiting of agents within the enemy personnel where they can learn the enemy's plans firsthand, steal the enemy's documents or materials, influence or misdirect the enemy's plans or policies. Suppose you had a chance to see some important document for just a few minutes. How quickly could you scan it for its essential content? How well could you separate the important from the unimportant? Could you record this information in a written message that can be easily read and will not be misinterpreted? Imagine that you are the leader of the patrol sent forward to observe and track an enemy column prior to a possible ambush. From time to time, you will need to send back your observations in written form. Each member must develop the ability to put his thoughts on paper in such a way that they will be easily read and unmistakable. The first two projects are designed to give the new member an opportunity to test these skills while learning or reviewing basic elements of espionage activity. When these have been completed, more advanced material will be furnished to the member directly. Useful intelligence projects of increasing complexity and importance will be assigned to those wishing to specialize in this work. Security. It is obvious what a great advantage we can gain over our enemies by proper information about their plans and activities. It is equally true that much of this advantage will be lost unless we can keep our plans and activities secret from them. This is the basic purpose of all security, and it is divided into five basic parts. A. Protecting the identity of underground personnel and their families. B. Keeping secret the location, movements, and plans of guerrilla bands. C. Keeping secret the location of guerrilla headquarters, alternate hideouts, and supply depots. D. Protecting the identity of civilians or individual members of the enemy population who are friendly to underground forces. E, maintaining secrecy of communications. As we have already said, it is difficult to even guess what forms the coming conflicts will take. Nevertheless, the strategy of all successful underground movements must satisfy these three basic principles. First, as a principle of deliberate delay. During this stage, the underground gathers its forces, checks its security, prepares its intelligence, establishes its lines of communication, and waits for the enemy to become complacent and overconfident. Second is the principle of provocation. At the beginning of this stage, only a few real patriots are willing to take part in underground activity. The vast majority of the population is still wishfully thinking that they can get along with the opposing forces. They want only to be left alone and will not take action until they are personally threatened. During this stage, the underground conducts a series of actions which provoke the enemy forces into making harsh repressive measures on the general population. This turns the general population against the occupying forces and convinces them that the underground is really their only hope. Stage three may be called the principle of natural allies. When the government's action against the general population becomes sufficiently brutal, then large numbers of people will be willing to help or join the underground. Their reasons for doing so may be numerous, and their ideology may not always be the same as the basic underground movement. During this stage, minor differences between different underground groups must be minimized, and all of our natural allies must be rallied to the cause of freedom. The intelligence branch of the underground is well aware of the communist infiltration and control of the present United States government. It can rightly be said that we are now partially controlled by a foreign ideology. Thus, we are already engaged in phase one of this conflict. How long this will continue until open warfare breaks out is anyone's guess. Once again, the best prediction of our intelligence department is that stage two will last for several months, perhaps even years. This will be a time of assassination and counter-assassination, terror and counter-terror. During this phase, the average citizen may avoid direct conflict at the price of his dignity and individual freedom. Known patriots will be in extreme danger. For most people, membership in the underground will not materially increase their danger during this time. For many years, our enemies have carefully cataloged the name and address of every person who has ever written a patriotic letter to a newspaper. The membership lists of the more prominent conservative organizations have long been available to communist infiltrators in these organizations. Continued activity and membership and other conservative organizations by members of the underground is desirable in many cases, but those individuals should not identify themselves as such. For most of our own members, it will be best if you do not take part in the activities of these other organizations. Although many of you are already marked men, a certain degree of security can still be achieved by quietly dropping out of other right-wing activities and keeping your membership in the underground secret from all except your most trusted fellow members. There may come a time when the average American is still able to go about his business with little regimentation, but during which you, as a known or suspected patriot, may be sought out for arrest or assassination. Propaganda. Another essential function of the underground is to convincingly inform the general public of what they stand for and thus gain the support of the general population. This must be done through propaganda, both written and spoken. Under conditions of enemy occupation, the spreading of anti-communist propaganda would obviously be very dangerous. Even now, there are certain phases of our propaganda effort that is best done by surreptitious means. Both observation communication, and propaganda are three elementary duties of every underground member. At the present time, we are engaged in a propaganda war. Never before has propaganda been so important to the ultimate outcome of a major conflict. The ultimate object of any war is to force your desires upon the minds of your enemies. All enemies are attempting to do this by the nonviolent means of psychological warfare. Later on in this training course, we will give heavy emphasis to the principles and actual use of propaganda warfare. Underground Training Program Phase 2, Intelligence. We are faced with a dangerous enemy who has repeatedly boasted of his plans to destroy our constitutional republic and to enslave our people. For more than 40 years, they have been infiltrating their agents into the most sensitive areas of labor, press, entertainment, education, law, communication, religion, industry, and government. The degree of their success is made obvious by our government's failure to oppose communism internationally and by our fellow citizens' lack of interest in their own preservation. We already know a considerable amount about this enemy, their origin, objectives, approximate strength, organizational structure, and general methods of operation. There are four areas that we especially need additional information. 1. Details of the techniques used in espionage, infiltration, and subversion by individual agents, including the methods by which they control their fellow travelers. 2. The equipment used for surveillance, communication, assassination, sabotage, etc. by individual enemy agents. 3. Working details of their short-range program, either in operation or planned for the near future. 4. The actual identity of enemy agents, fellow travelers, and sympathizers, along with details regarding their work, place of residence, cover operation, means of transportation, travel patterns, personal appearance, mental characteristics, personal lives, business, and organizational activities. Our ultimate victory or defeat may depend on our ability to obtain enough of this vitally important information. There are literally thousands of sources from which bits of valuable information can be obtained. These range from such extremes as the daily newspapers to documents stolen from the enemy's guarded vaults. The methods of gathering intelligence are roughly divided into two groups. 1, research and analysis, and 2, espionage. Espionage includes all the illegal means of obtaining information, such as wiretapping, interception of mail, stealing of documents, secretly photographing records, infiltrating spies into enemy organizations, bribing or blackmailing individuals of the enemy apparatus. Research and analysis includes the careful and systematic search of all newspapers, magazines, trade journals, house organs, political pamphlets, books, public records, etc., to sift a few needles of valuable intelligence from several haystacks of general information. Professional intelligence organizations obtain about 95% of their information from research and analysis, and only about 5% from espionage. When espionage techniques are used, they prove most effective when a specific mission is carefully planned out in advance, which takes advantage of all possible background information that may be obtained by research methods. By changing names and places, we can use an actual case to illustrate the combined activities of research and espionage within an organization. The names, dates, and places of this example have been changed. February 1962. One of the members in Ohio noticed a small article in a newspaper to the effect that a man we will call Professor E.C. Smythe gave a talk on civil rights to a local businessman's club. This member typed out a 4x6-inch index card and mailed it along with many similar cards to national headquarters. The card is dated. In the upper left-hand corner, it reads Smythe, Edward C., followed by his home address, his phone number. Occupation, Professor of Political Science, Bedrock College, Limestone, Ohio. Activity, gave talk on racial equality to Cleveland Rotary Club. Source, February 11, 1962 issue of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, page 8. Without any special notice, this card went into a file cabinet with thousands of others. April 1962. One of the members in Ohio wrote, using a fictitious name, expressed an interest in one of the left-wing peace organizations. Cards were sent in for each person whose name appeared as a sponsor on that organization's literature. Among these was a second card for Professor Smythe. August 1962. When one of the Communist Front organizations held a picnic rally near Columbus, Ohio, a team of members was there to record the automobile license numbers of all those attending. These were checked out by an associate member of the police force. Cards made out in the usual form were sent in. Among them was another card for Professor Smythe. When receipt of this third card, a yellow tag was placed in his front, and Professor Smythe was selected for special investigation. Additional information on his background was obtained from public records and from an innocent appearing letter of inquiry to the college where he teaches. There are other details were obtained from the Retail Credit Bureau. A check of our own files located only one member in the town where Professor Smythe lived, and that member had not been recently active. A visit from our regional coordinator reactivated the interest of this member, who, in turn, began a recruiting drive on the college campus for Professor Smythe's teachers. We developed three new members, one of whom was a student in Professor Smythe's political science class. This student soon joined the local student peace union, which was also sponsored by Professor Smythe. These members kept a close watch on his activities. From this combined infiltration and surveillance, we have learned a great deal of personal information about Professor Smythe, his methods of operation, and his associates within the communist apparatus. Here we have seen a case where research and analysis led to a suspected agent, but he might easily have been a dupe or a misguided liberal. An espionage follow-up has not only confirmed this man's full loyalty to the international communist conspiracy, but has since resulted in an additional penetration of that apparatus by our own agents. Now let's go back and examine how these various techniques might be used to obtain additional information of the four basic types we need most. 1. Details of the techniques used in espionage, infiltration, subversion by individual agents, including methods by which they control their fellow travelers. An agent trainee may learn something of the general espionage methods used by communist agents who have defected from the party and have then written about their experiences. Beyond this, they are of very little value. The actual details of such techniques are uniformly neglected. More useful information can be obtained from the study of past court records in which evidence has been presented in espionage cases. Hints and clues may occasionally be picked up from continuous and careful study of the regular news media. Really basic information of this type, however, must be obtained by infiltration and espionage techniques. 2. The equipment used for surveillance, communication, information sabotage, etc. by individual agents. hints about the type of hidden microphones, shortwave transmitters, miniature tape recorders, etc., used in surveillance and communication by espionage agents, sometimes are mentioned by chance in the regular press or news magazines in connection with reported spy cases. Technical details and construction plans occasionally are given in the electronics or popular science type magazines. Other information may be requested directly from the manufacturers of such equipment. The type of short-acting or long-acting poisons most suited for assassination under various conditions might be anticipated by a careful study of toxicology. From chemical abstracts and biological abstracts, from current magazines on pharmacology, as well as from such magazines as Scientific Monthly and Science Newsletter, are available from larger city libraries. Information on explosives is available from Ordnance Journal, literature from manufacturers, technical books, mining, drilling, and agricultural magazines, etc. Naturally, such special fields of interest are best pursued by some person who already has an aptitude in each particular line. This is one of the things that makes us feel that the American people are uniquely equipped to form a deadly, effective underground. Nowhere else in the world does any population have as many useful hobbies and avocations that could be adapted to underground warfare. Many byproducts or hobbies can be used as sabotage instruments. Just one typical example, the dust from grinding wheels in metal shops should be saved to mix with grease for the bearings of enemy machinery. And we'll continue in just a moment.
But while there's moonlight and Jesus and love and your woman, let's keep the music and before the fiddlers have fled. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's make the music and dance. Let's make the music and dance.
Ladies and gentlemen, was a 1958 recording of the incomparable Miss Ella Fitzgerald. Do you know what it means to have to face the music? This is a term that is generally used when discussing being forced against your will to confront a situation or circumstance with which you really do not want to deal. We are in the position in America today where we are going to be forced to face economic crisis.
There's just no getting around it. You must take steps to protect your assets.
If you have no assets,
you must take steps to ensure that you will be able to buy bread, milk, meat, pay for your transportation, your shelter, or perhaps even buy the life of a loved one with precious metals. In a time when the American currency is without value and trade will be restricted to what you can do on the black market.
Without precious metals, you will be trapped. Call Swiss America and ask them how they can help you with the acquisition of precious metals. Gold, silver, platinum, in whatever form you care to collect it. But do begin collecting. We have to get past the point of thinking that there's plenty of time to do this. There is not. So if you have not yet called Swiss America, don't delay to make that call now. See what they can do to help you with the acquisition of precious metals. We are going to have to face the music. And when we do, it's not going to be a romantic foxtrot. Call Swiss America. 1-800-289-2646. Thank them for sponsoring the Hour of the Turn. Again, 1-800-289-2646. Swiss America Trading.
If we Thank you. hero.
Say to that is amen. We will now continue with underground training, phase 2 intelligence, and we are in the process of examining how the techniques of research and analysis on espionage might be used to obtain additional information of the 4 basic types we need most. And we are now ready to deal with type 3. Working because of the enemy's immediate and future plans and activities. Advanced information about peace marches and racial demonstrations can be had by subscribing to appropriate Communist Front publications. Details as to the size of the demonstration and degree of violence anticipated must be obtained by infiltrating such organizations. Communist plans for future propaganda campaigns, subversion, espionage, blackmail of government officials, etc., may be learned directly by infiltration or may be deduced from a close study of their past activities. Type 4. Identity and personal information about enemy agents. This requires the full scope of counter-espionage activity. Research and analysis of enemy publications, monitoring of communist-sponsored writings, surveillance of party officers, infiltration of enemy apparatus, recruitment of double agents, interception of enemy communication, etc., etc. Techniques of effective research. 1. Every researcher should be constantly on the alert for useful information in the general news media, radio, TV, magazines, etc. 2. Each researcher should have one field of interest to which he gives special attention. For example, one researcher might read every book available on escape and evasion, and all the stories or articles written on prison escape, looking for ideas that might someday help our members escape from a concentration camp. Another researcher might specialize in electronic magazines, always searching for new information on radio communications, electronic surveillance, new types of burglar alarms, and so forth. Another researcher might continuously search the Communist Front publications for names of fellow travelers and announcements of future meetings, rallies, or similar activities for additional information that would tie suspected communists to known communist organizations, for friendship, business connections, and family relationships between known communists and unknown communists. Each city should have one researcher that carefully reads the daily papers to extract such information as names of speakers, random meetings, names and addresses of both left and right wing letters to the editor, social functions attended by known communists, names of persons who might be potential recruits, news of coming peace marches and similar demonstrations,
expressions of either pro- or anti-communist sentiment by local public officials, educators, businessmen, ministers, etc. Evidence of communist-inspired violence, sabotage, or blackmail. There is an almost endless variety of areas that need to be connected. Based on his or her own interests and abilities, each researcher should choose the specialty for which they are best qualified. Number three, be as specific as possible. Look for details. Include blueprints, drawings, or photographs of all technical equipment when possible. Don't expect your analyst to be a mind reader. Include all the facts. Continuously ask yourself the question, would this information be of value to the national headquarters, to individual agents, to other members, to our technical specialists? Fourth, avoid editorial opinions and general news items as these are of little value and needlessly swamp our limited staff and analysts. Five, do all the work locally that you possibly can. If the person is local, look them up in the telephone book or cross-index. Double-check to make sure the address is correct and that they still live there. Type cards if possible, otherwise print plainly. Include phone number and auto license number if possible. Six, use standard 4x6-inch index cards for sending in information on individuals. Clip pages of magazines or photostat important articles. In outlining books, be sure important facts are fully covered. And seven, always state the source of all information reported. Think like a footnote. Underground training program, phase three, security. Security and intelligence are like the two sides of a coin. In a way, they are opposites, yet they are always connected to one another. The security forces of each side continuously try to protect the secrets which the intelligence forces of the other side are continuously attempting to discover. Students of military history can point out countless cases where major battles or entire wars have been lost by faulty security. Proper security measures are obviously of great importance to conventional military forces, but they are infinitely more important to unconventional forces, guerrilla operations, patriotic resistance movements, and espionage networks. Although a belligerent nation may suffer a great loss because of poor security, it's hard to imagine a situation where a nation's defenses could be completely overwhelmed by a single security leak. Not so with unconventional forces. An underground movement might be totally annihilated as the result of a single security leak. A guerrilla band might be trapped and completely wiped out because of a single clue that gave away the location to the enemy army. Unburied garbage can attract birds to the guerrilla campsite, and birds can attract enemy soldiers. A carelessly dropped cigarette butt on a jungle trail can give away the band's direction of travel. More than once, an entire network of espionage agents has been rounded up because of some seemingly unimportant piece of information casually passed from one friend to another in idle conversation. Very seldom will one conventional military force have overwhelming superiority over another conventional military force. Such is not the case in conflicts between conventional military forces and underground resistance forces. Almost always, the conventional forces have to have necessary strength and equipment to easily round up and destroy the underground forces any time they can learn their identity and location. Thus, we see that underground forces have little or no defensive potential in the usual sense of the word. Their only defense is secrecy. Let us repeat this very essential fact. The only real defense of an underground movement is secrecy. This is even more true of individual espionage agents. Secrecy is your only defense. Good security begins with a clear understanding of the kind of information which the enemy intelligence will be trying to learn about you and your organization. A national government, a major military force, an underground army, an espionage agent, each will have different types of secrets which he must protect. Thus, each will place major emphasis on certain types of security measures. A national government must keep secret its diplomatic alliances, secret treaties, military plans, industrial potential, etc. Conventional military forces must keep secret their strengths, tactics, immediate and long-range strategy, movements, weaponry, reserve potential, troop morale, and physical fitness. They must also keep secret the type and extent of information which their own intelligence staff has or has not learned about their enemy. An underground resistance movement must keep secret 1. Their plans and methods of operation. 2. Their capabilities for movement and transportation. 3. The location, strength, and organization of guerrilla forces. 4. The strength of arms, food, and other supplies. 5. Available reinforcements. 6. Any contacts they may have with other resistance groups or friendly military forces. 7. Identity of friendly supporters in the general population. 8. Location and identity of individual members of the resistance movement, as well as the location or identity of their family or close friends. 9. Location of hideouts, base camps, storage areas, supply depots, etc. 10. Codes, signals, passwords, and lines of communication. 11. Most important of all, the underground movement must keep secret the extent and possible success of their own intelligence agents. By spreading rumors and false information, the underground may confuse enemy intelligence regarding the attitude of local inhabitants, current political and economic conditions, location and identity of underground leaders, health and sanitation conditions. Individual security is most important of all, the reason being that good organization of security begins with good personal security. A chain is no stronger than its weakest link. The individual member of an underground movement must, if he hopes to survive, do one of two things. A, if he is living under his own name, then he must keep his political beliefs to himself, and he must keep his underground activities and associations absolutely secret. B, if the member's underground associations are known or strongly suspected, then his only alternative is to adopt a completely new identity, occupation, and environment. The individual espionage agent has these same two choices available to him, but the need for complete deception is even greater. There is no one more completely defenseless than the individual espionage agent once his security has been compromised. Personal security is a 24-hour-a-day job. To some people, individual security measures must come almost instinctively. Others may find such measures very hard to develop. Each individual's own habits and personality traits will have considerable effect on his attitude toward various precautions of personal security. And here we must stop for this evening, ladies and gentlemen. I encourage you to think about this information, unpleasant though it is, with the attitude that it could be reality. We must be informed. We must be intelligently trained and understand what we are up against. And don't neglect to tell your family each and every day that you are living to nourish and cherish them. You are pulsing the blood in their veins. Good night, and God bless you, and God save the Republic. Oh,
Is it on this end that's causing it?
No, it's not on yours. It's on this end. It's me and this getting there and getting used to it and really not knowing what the hell I'm doing. So, you know, but eventually I will get it right. But anyway, what you need to do is organize the underground in sounds. And you need to organize it statewide, nationwide, everywhere, in every organization. And you must be prepared because pretty soon, I'm telling you, now, you don't have to believe it.
I do.
You don't, but you don't have to believe. No one has to believe me. I'm telling you, and I'm telling you, from all of the things that I've researched, all of the knowledge that I have, all of the people that I've talked to, including the enemy, I'm telling you right now, we don't have long to live as free people.
I believe God, 100%. 100%. We're going to end up like Carnival.
Yep, that's exactly right.
And they've been doing it to every country that's disarmed is under their power.
Yep, that's right.
I really, really like the statement that she made tonight about the Winchester factor. How many of one model they put out?
Yeah, just one model.
Absolutely.
By one firearms company.
Right. That's right.
You see, the estimates of how many firearms are in the hands of the American citizens is extremely conservative.
Exactly.
Unbelievably conservative. If you really wanted to know the truth.
That's true. That is true. Well, Bill, I'd like to call you tomorrow during the day at your think would be best. I'd like to discuss some stuff with you off the air.
Well, you can do that. But you know what? I just recently discovered that people have been calling me during the day, and I have had the phone right next to me, and it never rang. Never rang. Listen to me. There's obviously something wrong with this phone. Also, I went out today, and I bought a new phone, and so that problem should disappear after 7:30 in the morning, because I bought it as a charge for 14 hours. It will not be fully charged until 7:30 in the morning.
I'd never call you that early.
Well, you better not.
Nobody better. That's disrespectful.
Well, it's not only disrespectful, but I've already told the whole world, if you want to call me after 12 noon, my time, and before 5 p.m. my time, because I go on air at 6 my time, and I need that hour to make sure everything's okay.
Understood.
So it's between 12 my time and 5 my time. Anybody in the world can call me at 520-333-4578, and I will personally answer the phone, unless I'm not here, or unless I'm really extremely involved in something where I cannot possibly go to the phone. I have set that time aside to answer the phone personally for anybody in the listening audience who wants to call me.
Well, I really appreciate it, Mr. Cooper. I think this show tonight is, I've taped them all week. I was really fortunate to get enough tapes. I had 10 cassettes all filled up. I got to go back and get some more. And that's no problem. The information is just fantastic. And if they don't get it on their own, it's their loss. That's the way I see it.
Well, you're absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Well, I'm going to let you go.
Okay.
Appreciate your effort, Bill. You're doing a great job.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
520-333-4578 is the number. And we'll be taking calls from the listening audience until the end of the broadcast, which is about 6 minutes away, something like that. Anyway, 520-333-4578 is the number. What do you think about what you just heard? Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I would like to...
of the information that was really fine tonight. When you first look at what the person needs to do, sometimes it's a little overwhelming, and to have it organized and presented that way really does help out. Just how a person might collect information from almost any source, that in itself would seem, innocuous or wouldn't mean much, but then when you start actually collecting that information, it does really mean something.
Yeah.
I wish I would have got this information earlier, but it's really exciting, and it's not really exciting, it's just this may prepare ourselves, do what we can, and support the effort, I think, we have a better chance than if we wouldn't.
That's true, but let me tell you, if you had been listening to the Hour of the Sun for the past several years, you would have heard this years ago, because this was a rerun tonight.
Yeah, this might have been one of the reruns that I didn't hear. I have heard some real specific good ones along this line.
Please, specific good ones. Every broadcast the Hour of the Sun is specifically good.
Yes, I believe that. I guess that was the wrong way of saying it. I'm just
making a point here. Nothing personal.
Oh, no, but everything is. I remember doing certain books. I remember earlier programs of the Hour of the Time listed various books on the resistance movements concerning World War II and French resistance.
And Michelle did that also. Michelle, I have to say, for everybody who's listening, Michelle was one of the very best officers of the intelligence service of the Second Continental Army of the Republic. She got overloaded. She did some of the most incredible intelligence gathering feats, which you will find published in Oklahoma City Day One. She also became overloaded, if you will, and resigned her commission, and is not now a member of, and is not now affiliated with the intelligence service for the Second Continental Army of the Republic. And that nevertheless does not take away with the work that she has done and the credit that she deserves. So I want everyone to know that and be appreciative of it. There comes a time in everyone's service where they can either go on or they can't. And apparently, Michelle reached the point where she obviously could not.
I noticed that when she would talk about the Oklahoma City Big One book and gathering the information you had to go on the podcast, it seemed like those first few days she did such incredible amounts of work and was able to be organized and, at least that's what it came across. I know probably in any kind of work like this, there are moments of confusion, and it really takes a person to keep focused to be able to sort some of that out. But some of the information that was gathered there just really was amazing to me just in the first few days.
Yes, and if she had not done what she had done, and all of that information that was made available on the first day would not ever have been available to the general public probably ever again, simply because it was censored. And what you heard broadcast, even on the local television and radio stations in Oklahoma and in Oklahoma City, later was taken over and subverted by the information put out by the national news services, ABC, CBS, CNN, ABC, Associated Press, Reuters, whatever, and the things that the local reporters had reported initially that turned out to be absolutely 100% true were later said by the national networks and the communist news networks, if you will, you know, understand my meaning, was said to be false. And so Michelle did the very best job, and she is a great American patriot. We honor her here. We always will recognize her capabilities and her service, and she has a tremendous amount of credit due to her. And with that, we've got to say goodnight because this is it. This is the end of all.
Thank you so much for having me on the phone.
Well, you're welcome.
Oh, yeah, man.
Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you.
And that's it, folks. Good night. And God bless each and every single one of you.
Like me to work, I'm feeling 25.